This is it. The Series 1 finale of Beyond the Ballot. I'm Max, and today I'm joined in the studio by Rory. And this week we're focusing on the political shock that is now dominating Westminster. After months of speculation, mounting pressure, deteriorating polling, internal unrest, and growing concerns about Labour's direction, Sir Keir Starmer has announced his resignation as Prime Minister and Labour leader. The man who led Labour back into government, the man who ended 14 years of Conservative rule, the man who promised stability after a decade of political turbulence, has now stepped aside. And now British politics enters completely uncharted territory, because Starmer's departure isn't just about one politician. It's about the future direction of the Labour Party as we know it, the future of the government, and perhaps the future of Britain's entire political landscape. And at the centre of the conversation is one name, Andy Burnham, the Mayor of Greater Manchester, former Cabinet Minister, and increasingly the politician many believe could inherit the party. But if Burnham takes over, what would this government look like? Who would sit around his cabinet, and what challenges would he inherit? Today, Rory and I will delve deeper into this. So let's get into it.
So before we get into the actual Labour leadership saga, we need to look at how this began. And it happened from three by-elections that took place last Thursday. Two in Scotland and one in Makerfield. And before we get into the big one in Makerfield, we need to look at the two in Scotland.
Yes, of
First
course.
First one being in Arbroath and Broughty Ferry.
Yes.
That was an SNP hold, widely expected.
And Aberdeen South.
Aberdeen South is the biggest story.
Actually quite a big story. News.
I think it's a very under-told story, to be honest. That's even a word.
Yeah, because you see the Makerfield sort of overshadowing it.
We'll get into like a little bit of theory that I've thought about after this. But the Tories gained that seat from the SNP. All the commentators said, okay, the SNP are probably going to, it's going to be neck and neck, but the SNP are probably going to edge it out and probably win. But that is not what happened. The Tories took 50% of the vote to the SNP's mere 28. And that represents a more than 20 point lead, and actually a more than doubling of the Conservative vote from, I think, 24.4 to 49.5. That's up 25.1%. A huge win for Douglas Lumsden, who was
candidate,
but sworn into Parliament 2 days ago. Two days ago,
yeah.
We're recording on Wednesday, so not Monday. but those are the two big by-elections in Scotland. Obviously, one I think's really been on.
And then just to jump in there, I mean, fantastic news, really, for the Conservative Party. I mean, you think about the SNP. I mean, they are called the Scottish Nationalist Party. And really, I think a lot of people, I mean, I don't know about you, Rory, but I think going into this by-election, a lot of people thought the SNP would hold this seat, would you say?
Yes, exactly.
And for the Conservatives to come out with an overwhelming majority and to see the SNP crush with a very, very weak and timid percentage, as you mentioned before, shows the Conservatives broadening their reach beyond the stereotypical seats they would often win. And I think this is a really good sign. I think, do you not think, Rory, that this is showing the public and Kemi Badenoch that the Conservatives are not necessarily back, but they have this sort of credibility about them again, especially with the amount of time that they've had really to reflect on being in opposition and especially capitalising on Labour's repeated sorrows, would you say?
Look, I think this is obviously a huge win for the Conservatives. And I think it really gives the Conservatives, but more importantly, probably Kemi Badenoch, a spring in her step. I think you saw last month, the Scottish Conservatives particularly had a very devastating result. They won 12 seats, which is the lowest that they've ever won. I think the lowest before was 15 seats, and that was in the early 2010s during austerity and a lot of troubles with the Conservatives. But to then actually at that time, less than 2 months ago, the Tories won about 30% of the vote in the parallel, I like to say, almost constituency, because in the Scottish Parliament, it's pretty much this exact same constituency, it's just called something different, and it's obviously a different parliament.
Yes.
So the same demographics, the same sort of seat, if you will. And the SNP won that seat, obviously that triggered their by-election. They won 34% of the vote there. But what I think is very interesting is back then, the Tories already had put 6% up on their vote, if we're looking at the aggregate from 2024. And they've managed to galvanise and really unite that unionist vote. And you saw that a little bit from Reform, even though they didn't lose any votes on the sort of percentage sort of way of looking at things. They did lose votes in a sense because you see this huge polling lead, well, a consistent polling lead, sorry, for Reform. And you would expect for them to actually make some pretty decent gains in this by-election.
Yeah,
and they did not. They did
especially
not.
They
put on less than 2% of the vote, if I'm correct.
Yes.
And you saw Labour drop by 19 points. So I think you've seen a... and actually similar to what I mean in 2017, where actually a lot of the unionist vote has united behind the Conservatives. And 2017, yes, it was a bad year for the election for Theresa May, but it was cracking for Ruth Davidson and the Scottish Conservatives. I think they went from 1 to 13 seats. This seat, the Conservatives had an even larger share of the vote than they did in 2017, which was a notoriously good year for them.
Yeah.
And the swing is even larger than it was in 2017. So I'm not obviously foreshadowing that, oh, the Tories are going to win like massively at the next election in Scotland.
Well, yeah, of course. I mean,
but
that would just be jumping ahead.
A good sign.
Yeah. I think, yeah, I completely agree with you, Alan. I think that obviously this is a very, very large statement. And I don't think that people should be thinking now that, oh, yeah, the Conservatives are rolled back and they're going to completely dominate at the general election. But in terms of the positioning now, in terms of obviously we've spoken very often about in the previous episodes about the rise of Reform, it really shows voters that Kemi Badenoch and the Conservative Party are able to compete with Reform and are able to show the country that there are other options, and that the two-party politics is not as dead as people once thought it was. And despite the fact that Reform and the Greens are polling quite well, I mean, Rory, we've spoken a lot about how we think that, especially the Greens, how they're going to perhaps underperform at the next general election.
Yeah.
Especially with all, I mean, okay, you look at Gorton and Denton, oh, yeah, what a great victory. But if you look at the demographic there, then there's not much of a surprise, really.
No.
That they won that in the end. And I think.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I think that the optimism that is surrounding the Green Party now is one that is more about these small council seat gains and by-elections than the actual picture that we're going to get and representation when we actually get to the general election and we actually see who the public really want to see govern our country. Because at the end of the day, it's experience over popularity, wouldn't you say?
Yes, 100%.
Yeah,
just looking more specifically at the Greens, obviously I'm not going to make this whole podcast about them, but where's Zach Polanski gone? Like, before May, I saw Zach Polanski everywhere.
I think it's the comments about the murder of Henry Nowick has not exactly helped him, and I think...
I think he started to drop off
a little bit.
In all honesty, I haven't, like, totally been on... I haven't properly looked into that. I think that whole saga was more foreshadowed by how well Kemi did on that Good Morning Britain interview and actually how badly Nigel Farage did. So I think for me personally, and I'm obviously not a representative of the wider public, but I actually, his whole comments have kind of slipped under the radar for me a little bit.
Yeah, okay.
But I'm going to treat that as being true. But actually, there's been a whole lot. The main point being the Greens have not really been in the spotlight or in the headlines as they were before the local elections, and actually you see their polling is actually decreasing now.
Yeah.
After Gordon Denton,
well,
all the Labour people are being, oh, it's going to be really exciting.
Yeah.
I'm going to be a Green. I'm going to be radical. I'm going to properly get behind this party that truly epitomises what I've always wanted in the Labour Party. But feel just kind of evaporated.
Yeah, just to jump in, I mean, why do you think this is? Because for me, I feel like it's a bit of there's a lot of excitement about the Green Party, especially after Hannah Spencer's victory in Gorton and Denton. Mm-hmm. And then from then, it's sort of just been like a slow and almost gentle drop off. And we haven't really noticed it, really.
No.
People still just assume that the Greens are doing really well. But really, you've mentioned, well, people look at the polls, they are slowly declining. And now, what is the reason for this, would you say? I mean, is it the fact that there's a chance that, I mean, no, as in, okay, so they're losing a lot of support, mm-hmm. But it's decreasing gradually. And with the fact that Andy Burnham could potentially be the successor for Keir Starmer, we'll get on to his resignation later, what Andy Burnham stands for. But the fact that Andy Burnham is more left-wing than Keir Starmer means that he'll be able to appeal to these Green voters who were once very hardcore about the Labour Party and the traditional ideology about being a left-wing party that stands up for workers' rights. So I think that Andy Burnham's appointment would prove even more troublesome for the Green Party, especially with the lack of support, really, around their own leader. I mean, he's sort of, Zach Polanski's almost stopped making his appearances on TV and providing interviews. I mean, if Kemi is getting out there on Good Morning Britain and putting up a really good performance in every PMQ session, then she's already showing the public her message about what she intends to do for the future and what a Conservative government would do for them. But for the Greens, they speak a lot about, well, what I would say, fantasy economics, when really there is no proof that any of their fiscal ideas really work at all, would you say?
Yes, well, they've got like no experience. People can rightly criticise Reform for not having a lot of experience. And the experience they do have is one of failure and not success, pretty much. The Greens have nothing. And I think you've seen that. And I think actually you can make a wider point about Reform here, is that the Greens were put under the spotlight and they cracked, and they cracked quite quickly under that pressure. I think Reform have done pretty well. I think we can agree so far to almost get through that pressure so far. Obviously now that pressure is almost, it's beginning to take a toll on the party. Obviously that loss in Makerfield, a problem with candidate selection and comments and everything. But we'll get into that when we talk about Makerfield. I think the Greens have just, I think the more the people see of the Greens, the less they like of them. And I think the opposite is true for Kemi Badenoch, where the more you see of them, the more you support her.
Yeah.
So that's my diagnosis of the problems with the Greens. But fundamentally, the Greens are lunatics, so in my opinion. So I'm glad that a lot of people across the country are actually seeing them for who they are, which are just the epitome of pure incompetence.
Yeah. And okay, so we've looked at those two by-elections there and the supposed decline in two-party politics and what's really happening to the Green Party now. But if we look, skim over quickly the Makerfield by-election, what a fantastic victory for Andy Burnham himself. The King of the North showing his dominance, really, and his ability to beat Reform, Rory, wouldn't you say? And I think that gives Labour voters confidence.
Yes.
Would you not say?
Yeah. No, I think there are a lot of lessons for the Labour Party in what happened in Makerfield. And I think it is particularly good for Andy Burnham, not least he won the seat. But he actually shows us that, obviously yesterday was 10 years on from the Brexit referendum. Today is the 10-year anniversary of David Cameron's resignation as Prime Minister. So it's almost resignation season in early summer. But the point I'm trying to make is Makerfield's a heavily Reform voting constituency, 65% for Leave.
Which is why he suddenly stopped saying,
yes, well,
let's
okay, we'll
rejoin
get into that.
The
we'll
EU.
Get into that. In the local elections, Reform won 51% of the vote across the Makerfield wards. So that's a majority.
Yeah.
And they won all 8 seats on, I think, Wigan Council.
Yes.
It is a 97% ethnically white constituency. It is heavily resided by homeowners, and there's quite an elderly population as well. So if there are any, and it's actually also quite working class. So if there are any seats that Reform should properly, it's 30th on their target list as well. So if there are any seats that Reform actually needs, not only to be the largest party or even get a majority, but let alone get 50 seats at the next election, this is one of the seats that they had to win. Yeah. And the fact that they lost it by 20%, I think, shows not only that this is a disaster for Reform, but against all the odds, against all the demographics, Andy Burnham, a Labour candidate, has managed to show to the Labour Party, look, I'm not the most right-wing person on earth. I'm on the soft left of the party, but I can still beat Reform in the places that they consider to be their own backyards. And I think that is extremely important for the Labour Party, because it shows that they don't actually have to be quite hawkishly right-wing. They can also be, they can stick true to their socialist values without losing the votes of people that you'd expect to see in the red wall, working class, culturally quite conservative, but economically quite socialist. And at the beginning, that was where Reform managed to really hit hard with their voting base. So Andy Burnham has managed to show the Labour Party that he can win in places that Reform should comfortably win in.
Yeah.
While being quite a left-wing person. And obviously you can say, well, he actually took quite a right-wing campaign. He said that he wants to keep immigration low. He opposes having another referendum. And obviously that was to try and play with those demographics. But in the grand scheme of things, particularly with the Brexit referendum, it's actually not a defining issue in the country right now. You have immigration and the economy, and actually defence is becoming a bigger issue in the UK. Those are the three main issues that the public will be voting on at the next election, not on
the referendum
another Brexit
every 10
referendum.
Years.
Unless you're a Lib Dem
and
who
I think that Wes Streeting attempting to reopen that can of worms is just completely unnecessary, especially since he's just, just backed Andy Burnham.
Yes, well, it's quite a coincidence that Wes Streeting started talking all about the Brexit referendum and rejoining and whatever as soon as Burnham was put forward to stand in a constituency, which is heavily Leave. That's sabotaging your own.
And as soon as Burnham wins, he falls in line, attempting to get a good cabinet position. Anyway, we'll speak about that later. But in terms of reform, they obviously were very close to winning this seat at the general election. And going into it, you would think, in theory, that Reform would do a job on Andy Burnham. Because if you think about it, I thought Andy Burnham would have won it going into the by-election, but I didn't think it would be as such a solid and convincing victory, because I thought, as from a Makerfield, as a person who lives in Makerfield, they would think that Andy Burnham was simply using their constituency as a stepping stone for the top job, and he didn't really take into account the potential issues in the area. But credit to him, I guess his campaigning must have been excellent to be able to get 55% of the vote. And now that obviously Keir Starmer has stepped down, he'll obviously be running. He's obviously announced that he'll be running a leadership challenge. And I think that Nigel Farage will be feeling worried. I think he's already shown that he can defeat Reform, especially in a place that was heavily Leave. And I think that Andy Burnham, a lot of people were concerned about how he'd be able to manage the whole country, Rory, wouldn't you say? Because especially since Andy Burnham, okay, he was the mayor of Greater Manchester, but Manchester's only a specific area of England. It's not the entire country. How's he going to be able to manage the wants and needs, perhaps, of people who aren't working class.
Yeah.
He can't just adhere to a certain group. I mean, I know the Labour Party was all about stepping up for the, standing up for the working class, but he really needs to think about everyone really in the UK and how his decision making and how his cabinet really is going to operate, especially with this almost the stunt in economic growth. I mean, Keir Starmer talks all about how, oh, he's brought inflation down, but we'll really come on to talk about later about the legacy of Starmer. But really, I think that this is a tremendous victory for Andy Burnham and the Labour Party, and one that should be celebrated, wouldn't you say, Rory?
I mean, yes,
it's a fantastic 100%. Victory.
Well, it is a fantastic victory, and Labour haven't been shy in celebrating
that,
if
yeah.
you will. I think at the same time, they don't have enough time to celebrate because they've actually got some work to do.
Yeah, they do have
getting
to
rid
get
of
on
a
with
prime
it.
Minister and putting in a new prime minister. And as I said, this is a great result for the Labour Party. It's given them a lot of hope and confidence, not only of, oh, we're going to get absolutely, like, expletive. We're going to, the next election is going to be rough for us. instead of that, well, not only that, you've also got the argument where actually, you know, we can be who we want, as in we can stick with our values without worrying about electoral annihilation at the next election, which actually,
yeah, they don't have to shift their values.
Well, they
as
can
a party.
Stay, they can continue to be Labour, without obviously worries of being suppressed from the right, from Reform, or the left, from the Greens. They can properly kind of retain that big tent party sort of structure that they've historically held. And I think, obviously, I'm in total agreement with you, Max. This is a good result for Labour.
And now, on to Westminster, where Labour is now facing one of the biggest political transitions in modern British politics. Officially, Keir Starmer says he's stepping down to allow new leadership and fresh energy to take the Labour Party into the second half of its five-year term in power. But few people in Westminster believe this happened overnight. The reality is that several pressures on Keir Starmer have been building for months. And from my point of view, this was inevitable. So what drove Keir Starmer out? Well, the first one I want to address is polling collapse. Because as of a few weeks ago, the last time I checked, Keir Starmer was one of the most unpopular prime ministers ever, even more unpopular than Liz Truss in her mini-budget crisis and Boris Johnson. And what really underpins this as well is the idea that Labour's lead and very impressive majority win in 2024 has steadily been eroded by which parties? Now, one would assume that it would be the Conservative Party taking back power under new leadership and fresh energy. But really, it's now multipolar politics now, and it's not just two parties. Now, Reform UK, especially after the council elections making many gains in former Labour heartlands, the Conservatives showing signs of recovery, winning seats in Westminster in the local council elections. And Labour MPs were becoming increasingly nervous about their own electoral prospects. Now, Rory, let's touch upon the Labour MPs and some of the resignations that have happened recently.
Yes.
Now, I don't think we've actually touched his resignation as Health Secretary. And I think that, Rory, this was the beginning of Starmer's downfall.
Yeah.
Would you say?
Yes.
Yeah. And especially with the resignation of John Healey, who was, of course, Defence Secretary, around the row about defence spending and really where was the money going to come from? Because there was a massive black hole, really, in Starmer's plan about funding more, about finding the funds to increase defence funding. Now, I, for one, Rory, would have thought that this would have come from the welfare.
Yeah.
But of course, it's not in Labour's nature to cut welfare. And this was immediately a problem. And straight after this, of course, Al Khan's resignated himself, didn't he? And what's even more interesting about this is that he still hasn't ruled himself out of a leadership contest. And now, despite the fact that he's, of course, resigned, he is still able to run for the top job. And I don't particularly think that he stands much of a chance against Andy Burnham, even if he did run. So the chances, really, of him being able to make an impact, really, on this leadership race is very slim. And I think that in terms of people who should challenge Andy Burnham, really the only person who's got much of a chance is Wes Streeting. And he's, of course, just backed Andy Burnham himself. So really, could this leadership contest be already over? Another factor that's also played a part in the decline of the Labour Party is the rise of Reform UK. Now, Labour has consistently struggled since 2024 to develop a convincing answer to reform, would you say, Rory?
Yeah, they have. And that's led Keir Starmer to drag the Labour Party to the right. Obviously, he really made the Labour Party quite centrist going into the 2024 election, but particularly after 2025 and those local elections, he started to drag the government more hawkishly right-wing, particularly on immigration, a bit more on justice as well, and that argument of two-tier policing. But that clearly hasn't worked because Reform are still ahead in the polls, and actually Labour's started to lose votes on its left flank to the Green Party, or at least it did. It's been a failed strategy from Keir Starmer's part.
And, okay, if we look at the rise of Reform UK, obviously they target issues such as immigration, crime, national identity. And these policies that they've targeted have really appealed to the British public. And I think that Reform have really tried to capitalise on the events of the last few weeks in trying to boost their public image. Of course, overshadowed by Nigel Farage's alleged £5 million gift.
What do you mean alleged?
That he's received.
He did receive it.
Yeah, but of course, he didn't document it. And I guess we never really know what he did with it. But of course, that's not the point. The point is that Reform increasingly looked like the party that was now setting the agenda, and that Labour looked like the party reacting to it instead, clearly showing that Keir Starmer had lost control of his own party. Now, Roy, another reason for me, I would say, is economic disappointment, wouldn't you say? I think that as soon as Rachel Reeves was appointed as Chancellor, I didn't really know a lot about her, so I went digging a little bit, and her track record is not exactly the shiniest. And I think especially after her 2 years now as Chancellor of the Exchequer, it's shown the country that her approach is not right in any way, really. I mean, it's just causing growth to be sluggish. Living standards have improved, but very slowly. And the Labour Party talk about success in these areas, but it is very, very small, the sort of success we're talking about. Talking about NHS waiting list down, or number of net migration being down, but net migration's only down because more people are leaving the country anyway.
Yeah.
And that's because of their tax system. Because Labour cannot change. They're not chameleons. They can't change their DNA, their identity. They're always going to be about high taxes, wealth distribution, relying on the welfare system. And really what we need now is to have market reassurance. And I think Rachel Reeves, with her decisions recently, I mean, we've spoken about the completely useless decrease in the taxes on some activities. Okay, that's a great idea, but the summer only lasts a certain amount of time. And really, don't you think there are such greater concerns and issues facing our country right now?
Well, yeah.
Instead of just that.
Well, exactly. I think that particular policy, what are you trying to get at? Oh, I want the I want British people to be able to do something in the summer, because obviously flights are getting pretty expensive and they may not be able to go to holiday destinations, which they in other cases normally would. And I think she's looked at it in the perspective of, okay, that's the way it is. What can I do from there? I think she's then assuming that they can't go on holiday, but I think you could almost sort of bring that, not level of taxation, but those changes could be brought earlier up the line, instead of putting my money in cutting taxes in holiday places in the UK, why not I cut levies on airplane use? So may then more people, it's actually cheaper for people to leave the country and go to like Spain or something, for example.
Yeah.
I think that's the approach that she should have taken, instead of, okay, that's the way it's going to be. I might as well just cut £1.65 for every ticket to the Brighton Pavilion or whatever.
Yeah. And currently for me, I think going into this summer, people aren't necessarily very optimistic. I mean, what is particularly wrong, I think, with Labour's tax system and the way that they are trying to raise money is the fact that they simply increase the taxes that take away the incentive for people to work anymore.
Yeah.
We want a country that boosts ambition, productivity. We want our businesses. We want competitive markets. But instead, what we've got is businesses not even being able to employ more people. We've got the highest number of people who are not in education, employment, or training that we've ever had. And I think Andy Burnham, if he is to come in with his new chancellor, especially with the fact that Rachel Reeves is most likely to be shipped off to a junior junior position,
as well.
I think that the new prime minister needs to assure the markets. We need to not do anything too risky, but we also need to look at Andy Burnham can't suddenly take this massive lurch to the left. Okay, no. He needs to think about the position that Labour Party are currently in and think of what's going to boost the productivity here. And I know that it's not in the Labour Party's DNA or identity to cut specific taxes like national insurance that we've mentioned before, or just cutting the basic rate of income tax. Because if we give more money back to the people, Rory,
yeah,
we increase the amount of money that they spend on businesses because they have more disposable income, the businesses profit more, and then it ends up in this multiplier effect. More people are employed, businesses continue to grow, markets continue to thrive. And eventually, the billionaires that left the UK because of Rachel Reeves will be thinking, we've made a mistake here. Because really, a lot of our GDP comes from them.
Yeah.
And we're losing these people who are really important in contributing to our society, wouldn't you say, Rory?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. And that's just my opinion on the economic disappointment that Labour have inflicted on themselves, really. But in terms of the internal issue, seriously bad for Keir Starmer. I mean, I wouldn't want to, you know, get us banned or anything, but the words that can describe Keir Starmer as a leader cannot even be used on this podcast, really. I think
he was not
even in control of his own party, even to the day where he resigned. We look at the Peter Mandelson crisis. That is arguably one of the defining moments of his tenure as the lead at the Labour Party. To have appointed someone like Mandelson and then blaming your own staff for not even checking his background information just shows clearly Keir Starmer's incompetence with anything, really. Roy, would you say?
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's really a tragedy that it's Keir Starmer's mistakes that's costing people their jobs, when it is actually their job to execute what his government's, or by extension himself, commands are. And I think with that particular case, not least the actual initial act of appointing a security threat to one of the most highly sensitive ambassadorial roles in British diplomacy, but also the whole saga that happened after that, I think really highlighted the unprofessionalism and the irresponsibility that the government is taking.
Yeah, I mean, he's got to take responsibility, and he never did. He just fired Sir Ollie Robbins for no reason, and then he testified against him anyway. So that was a complete faux pas on his part. And to appoint someone with links to Jeffrey Epstein and Prince Andrew in a position as important as being the ambassador to the United States of America, a country that, well, we once held a special relationship with until Keir Starmer came in and completely destroyed the relationship with Donald Trump. I think even for Americans, they're going to remember Keir Starmer as someone who did not have an impact at all in the States. When he came over, he was weak. He saw Donald Trump's image and he was intimidated by him. Mm. I think that in terms of international relations, a lot of the work was just being done by Yvette Cooper anyway, the foreign secretary.
I think she's done a very good
instead job. Instead of Keir Starmer himself. What? Sorry, expand on that. I like that point.
I think out of the cabinet ministers that have performed the best, I think that Yvette Cooper has done a particularly good job. You can argue that Keir Starmer and Donald Trump have been ping-ponging spats for the past 6 months or so. And you can say, oh, that's foreign, isn't it? So isn't that under Yvette's brief? But I think it's far more personal between Donald and Keir. I think particularly with the Iran crisis, I think Yvette's done a very good job.
And Keir did not do a good job. Let's just clarify that.
Not only with kind of, I think, sorry, what did you say?
Keir did not do a good job with that.
No, Keir's not.
Because he completely fumbled.
He fumbled the ball, and yes, oh, I didn't want to lead us into war. Yes, that's fine. That's okay.
But, no,
that's
no,
a totally
no, no,
sound
yeah,
opinion,
I get what you mean, but like,
not, to support your ally.
Yeah, but he's halfway. You either are fully committed or not in it at all. He's in the middle.
Well, I would say
he has no stance.
Well, I think he's very much in the middle. I don't think you need to be fully on one side or fully on the other.
No.
I think that's where Keir Starmer thinks he is, where he's like, oh, well, I'm definitely on the American side. I'm not saying, like, I'm definitely on the American side. I mean, I'm the UK. And so obviously I'm on that side of the spectrum. But you actually haven't said anything to justify where you are as far as who you're supporting, and you've got a terrorist state in Iran, and you've got your number one military ally, well, scrap military, just your number one ally in the world. And I think you should pretty strongly be backing the Americans. And you saw Keir Starmer said, oh, I didn't want to get involved. Well, I don't think the Americans really wanted to get involved when the Bosnia crisis happened, but they did. Yes, you can say, oh, well, we got involved in, what, like, Korea, or we didn't get involved directly in Vietnam. But in Vietnam, even Harold Wilson verbally supported the Americans. Keir Starmer hasn't done that. And I think that up to that point, he did a pretty decent job as far as managing that relationship. Obviously, you have Donald Trump, who is on one side of a coin, and you have Keir Starmer, who's on the other side of the coin. You didn't think that they could ever see eye to eye, and actually, to a point, they did pretty well. And I think with that particular issue, and I think you could have seen that almost started to sprout when Maduro was captured, I think shows that the one area where Keir Starmer did pretty well up to a point, he's actually lost. And I think in the midst of that, Yvette Cooper's done a pretty good job with all the other stuff that's going on at the moment. And I also like, I think she speaks the most common sense to me. And I know she's like on the center, that she's a centrist, and she is quite, and she's a very experienced politician. She served in Miliband's shadow cabinet back in the early 2010s. So I do like Yvette as a, I think her personality is quite, she's quite likable in a way that some other Labour figures just aren't at the moment.
Yeah, and here's just a question for you, Roy, before we wrap up this segment for the final time on Keir Starmer's legacy, really. Roy, do you think Keir Starmer was brought down by events or by expectations? It's surrounding the how they would govern?
I think it's a very good question. I think he's been brought down by events. I think you saw at the general election, there was no real sort of excitement for Labour. So as far as the expectations concerned, that somewhat weakens that argument. I think that the events, the number one most controversial sort of sticking point, but traits tied with Keir Starmer is his amount of U-turns. And in a way, you can say that's an event. In a way, you can say the Iran crisis is an event, because that's how you lost that sort of foreign argument that you once had. You can say that, obviously, just tying into the Iran war, there's an economic crisis going on at the moment, particularly with fuel that we did see in 2022 when Ukraine was obviously attacked, and it still is. And he hasn't managed to properly tackle that issue. So I think that it is certainly events. I think there is definitely an expectation sort of element to it.
Yeah.
He says he was going to be a break from the Conservatives. He'd said that he's going to restore trust into politics. Well, you didn't get 6 months before the Lord Ali stuff came out. But no, I think events is, and his failure to properly tackle those issues are likely what is the catalyst for his downfall. And that's what's going to define his legacy.
Yeah. And I personally, like when he was stood up there and he was delivering his final address to the public, really, as the Prime Minister, I thought to myself, despite the fact that him and I don't really see eye to eye, I did feel sorry for him.
Oh, I felt very sorry for him.
I felt
in
that,
a way, and I think you may see this with him. I want to emphasise the may. But when Rishi went, everyone started loving Rishi, and that's because Keir was really bad. But I had a very, very small glimpse of that's kind of sad, like kind of an end of an era type thing. And obviously he's probably quite attacked.
To think we are going into the unknown now about what would happen next to the country. And I think Keir Starmer, the trust he's put in the system, I mean, he's being Prime Minister is no easy job.
No.
I think we can both agree on that. And
I think
despite the fact that
I'm not going to say he's done a good job, because that's very...
He's put up a valiant effort, despite the fact that...
We feel like somewhat sorry for him, but I don't think we should be overcompensating.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess that, you know, now is time for the next Labour Prime Minister to take up the reins and take the country in the correct direction. But
so help us God.
Who will it be? So we've spoken about the resignation of Keir Starmer. We've spoken about the Makerfield by-election, but what do we know about Andy Burnham? And what does he really offer? Now, in comparison to Keir Starmer, Andy Burnham is a lot more left-wing, you could say. I mean, especially since Keir Starmer veered the party into the centrist point of view, wouldn't you say? Mm-hmm. And I think Burnham's appeal is not just about policy, but it's about this... about tone as well. I mean, he's looking to the people. He's looking to restore trust in a failing system, as he's phrased it many times before. And he speaks to many of the lost voters of Labour, wouldn't you say, Rory? Many of the people who left to go to the Green Party.
Yes, I think that's the main argument.
Yeah, because he's consistently focused on the idea of strengthening public services, communal and community identity, trying to restore with balance in terms of this economic inequality that's consistently growing. I mean, you see an increased number of people on benefits and utilising the welfare system. And he is a lot more socialist, as you'll have it, than Keir Starmer.
Yeah.
I mean, I heard that this was in an article by the Times, that he wanted to increase the top band of tax paying to 50%. And this is perhaps giving a sign already to the British public that he's not looking to cut taxes anytime soon, despite the fact that he did say, I think, can you back me up here? He did say he'd cut welfare to boost defence.
He did say that.
I was surprised at seeing, but that could have been a tactic. That could have just been a tactic to appeal to the public. Prime ministers say many things, and they don't often always happen. I mean, that's seen by Keir Starmer at general election anyway. But if we look at the risks of Andy Burnham, Rory.
Yeah.
If,
risks.
If, no, no, no. There are risks associated with...
Of course
with,
there are risks.
With any...
Yes, well, there are a lot of risks with Andy Burnham.
With any appointment. But, yeah. I mean, Keir Starmer's idea was... Well, not idea, but when he came in, he wanted to show the country that there would not be this collapse and regression that the Conservative parties had where they went through prime minister after prime minister, as this was not fair for the country. Mm. The country wants to see a government that is not only able to make decisions and function, but a prime minister who has the right amount of strength when it comes to decision making, but also charisma as well. I mean, Andy Burnham has that charisma,
yeah,
wouldn't you say? But also now it's time for us to see what he's really about. And I think we're going to see that straight away, especially when he announces his cabinet in September, if no one challenges him, or if he actually wins a leadership contest if someone challenges him. But the risks are is that running, as I mentioned before, Rory, running Greater Manchester is not the same as running Britain. And voters may ultimately demand answers on an international scale, wouldn't you say? I mean, Burnham is going to have to deal with these big personalities.
Yes, well, okay. But like Burnham has not, he's been in like easy level.
Yeah.
He's collecting money from the government. He's not like, he doesn't have as a profound impact.
He's got these little nice local achievements. Okay, you've improved a tram service in Manchester.
Well, I'm not, let's not like kind of be disingenuous to his achievements, but the point we're trying to make is that he's in charge of spending money rather than collecting money.
Yeah.
So he's not very much, he can kind of go out there and say, I'm spending this, and this without having to say, oh, but we have to spend or we have to tax X amount more, which is a optimal position you can be in. You can always take all the credit for everything that's going on that's good without taking the baggage of actually delivery or having to impose certain costs on the people, which the government has inherited. And I think he'll see the other side of that coin, where actually instead of being the one who's making the spending announcements, particularly in Manchester, where he used to be, he's actually the one who's now saying, oh, well, this is where it's going to come from, or this is where it's going to be cut from.
Yeah, because obviously he's going to have to find room. I mean, I saw in another article that I was reading the other day that Keir Starmer wants to keep going with these defence boosts.
Yeah.
But Burnham will potentially cut them. Because
Burnham won't cut defence, I don't think.
No. As in, no, sorry. That's a poor choice of wording. He doesn't want to cut defence, but he might halt the sudden increase in funding.
Oh, okay.
Because he doesn't believe that the money is there.
Oh, okay. Right.
And there's going to be a way to generate that money. And for him, that's increasing the top band of income tax, 50%.
Yeah.
As I've spoken about earlier. And I think it'll be interesting to see how Burnham reacts with issues such as, will he go through with the social media ban?
Yeah.
On under 16s. I personally, for me, getting a bit sidetracked here, I think that was a correct decision from Keir Starmer.
So, well, that's a whole other podcast.
With the ban. But that will be for another episode. What's important now is looking at, is Andy Burnham really the future of Labour or simply the most obvious alternative? Because I think that Andy Burnham will lead Labour into the next general election. But I do not think that Andy Burnham will remain as the leader of the Labour Party for more than 3 to 4 years, I would say. I don't know about you, Rory.
I'm not going to make any big conclusions, but I'm going to say he's got about 3 or 4 years as well.
Yeah,
I'm with you on
because
that.
I do think that he is the correct decision now for the long term. I think someone in waiting, someone like Wes Streeting, he's waiting for the right moment. He'll let Andy Burnham have his moment in the spotlight. He'll get a good cabinet role and then he'll simply wait his time. But
I think that's what he's trying to
do. Yeah, that's what I totally agree with you on. But what would Andy Burnham's cabinet really look like? Now, if Andy Burnham does enter Downing Street, attention immediately turns to the cabinet because cabinets reveal priorities and they reveal strategy. So let's look at the position of the Chancellor of the Exchequer. Now, Rory, we've spoken off the podcast about how we know or think that Rachel Reeves is most definitely going to be removed.
She's gone.
But Who would you bring in? I mean, names are swirling around. Ed Miliband.
Who would I bring in? I'd bring in Claire Coutinho, but I can't do that. I would, if I was Andy Burnham, or actually, I don't put this on me. I think a better question is, who do you think Burnham's going to?
Who do I? Oh, who? Okay,
who, do you, no, sorry. No, who do you think Burnham's going to put in? I think he's going to put
Ed Miliband.
I think he's going to put Ed Miliband in
because he's an advocate for Burnham.
Well, like he was the one who first went out there and said, "Okay, you've got your time's up, mate. You've got to go. There's the door."
Yeah, I personally don't like the idea of Ed Miliband as Chancellor.
I don't.
I don't like the idea of Ed Miliband.
No, I don't like.
I think the push for net zero, especially since he was the Energy Secretary, can translate into his policies as Chancellor. And I think that he's not going to be very reassuring for the markets. And I think some of his decisions could cause a very dramatic change, potentially, depending on the angle they want to come from. I mean, depending on how they want to address the black hole spoken about in the defence spending and the potential how welfare needs to be cut. But if we look at Wes Streeting, for example, his name has been in there a little bit about potentially being the new Chancellor of Rory. I mean, I never really thought of Wes Streeting as a potential person to really take up the role of Chancellor. I don't know about you, but I think this is very clever from Wes Streeting to be able to realise that the time is not quite right for him, and to back Burnham will potentially put him in a good position in the future to potentially take the role as Prime Minister or even get a very good cabinet role, would you say?
I think he's played it the right way.
Yeah. And if we look at the different other cabinet roles as well, I think Home Secretary, I think Shabana Mahmood will stay.
I think she should stay because she's making good progress.
She should stay. Even though I could see do you not think there could be a clash between the two?
Burnham,
we know Starmer's a bit more centrist than Burnham, but Burnham's immigration policies are a bit more left-wing, might not align, could be a fallout. Mm. I mean, the policies Shabana's trying to implement are quite far down the line.
Yeah.
And it'll be a bit risky to change them because you're completely undoing the work of the previous government, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think Shabana definitely needs to stay as the Home Secretary.
I think she should because I think she's doing a cracking job.
I think for the foreign's interesting because I think
Yvette is doing well. I think that Yvette will probably go just to kind of differentiate himself from Keir. But I think she is, in all fairness, doing a good job. And I wouldn't be surprised if she probably gets put in some junior place. But I think that her being moved will less be about the fact that she is like incompetent, which she is not. I want to put it on the record. I think it will be more of a political decision rather than a personal decision.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think this is a really interesting one to talk about. Deputy Prime Minister. Now for me, I think maybe a cheeky Angela Rayner, maybe.
Oh, coming back for an encore.
That's not even, I do think that she's ready. She's ready to go back into politics. I think she's cleared up.
I think, look, well, I don't...
She's cleared up her issues, apparently, but...
I don't really like Angela, as she is, but I think you can't deny that she is a big beast in the Labour Party.
She is a very influential person, and I think she and Burnham would get on very well, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
I think they do see eye to eye. I mean, they're both from Manchester themselves, and I think that would be a very... very interesting partnership to see how that plays out. Now, Roy, what do you think about Burnham's supporters? You know, Lisa Nandy. Do you think she's going to be getting a good role in this cabinet?
Lucy Powell.
What do you think?
I don't know. I think that she is. I think Lisa Nandy. I think she's everyone's going to talk about her, but I don't think that she's like. Properly, I don't think she's a big beast. Like, yeah, she stood in the last a leadership election. She didn't do like stunningly well, and she's the culture secretary. Like, when's the last time that the culture secretary's kind of been like in the spotlight? Like what?
You think about it. But everyone in Liz Truss's cabinet were her supporters.
Look where Liz Truss got.
Yeah. That's a good point as well.
And I think,
but it's not been unheard of that someone who's not really.
Well, yes, but I think you can play a counter argument that Margaret Thatcher, God love her, she put a lot of her, not enemies, but people from different factions of the Conservative Party into her cabinet, and that was more to be able to challenge her, because what's the point of having a cabinet if everyone agrees with you? Like, it might as well be an autocratic system.
Yeah.
So I don't think Lisa Nandy's very much a huge figure on the left. I think that she may get a cabinet role. She may stay in culture because she hasn't mucked it up like a lot of other secretaries of state at the moment. But she was campaigning in Makerfield, which is right next to her seat of Wigan. So maybe there's an odd chance that she gets it, but I don't think she's very much someone that Andy's going to have to appease.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. And we will, of course, see when we get back. And unfortunately, that is time up on the Series 1 finale of Beyond the Ballot. But just to close out, what should you, the listener, watch out for this summer? Now, regardless if you ultimately win the leadership contest, this summer could define the rest of the Parliament. Here are the key things we're watching. Labour unity. Can Labour emerge from this transition stronger than before? Or will the divisions become more visible? The Andy Burnham idea and vision. If Burnham wins, what is his defining mission for the United Kingdom? Is it regional reward? Is it economic growth? Or is it public service reform? Reform UK's next move should be something that is carefully followed. Can reform turn momentum into long-term political power? Or is it part of a short-term blip? Or does Labour's leadership change slow their rise? And finally, the economy. Growth figures, inflation, consumer confidence and employment. Because really, these numbers may matter more than any leadership speech in itself. Now, to close out, it's important to understand that we have looked beyond the headlines in this episode surrounding the resignation of Sir Keir Starmer. Because while leadership changes often dominate the news cycle, they rarely answer the deeper questions that face our society and country on a day-to-day level. Questions about economic growth, questions about public services, questions about the public's trust in politics, and about whether Britain's political system can still respond to an increasingly restless public electorate. The next Prime Minister may change, but the challenges waiting on the desk in Downing Street remain exactly the same. And as Andy Burnham emerges as the leading contender to take over the Labour Party, attention will turn to who joins him, what he stands for, and whether he can succeed where others have struggled. Thank you for listening to this episode of Beyond the Ballot and for supporting us throughout the year. And see you in the autumn for the beginning of season 2. Thank you and goodbye.
Thank you.